Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It was the week of Obama. Ceremony, tears, and challenges stacking up. The new president, President Obama, promised a new era.
Know that America is a friend of each nation and every man, woman, and child who seeks a future of peace and dignity. And we are ready to lead once more.
The new Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, moved in, ready to go.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, let's get to work.
Thank you, and God bless you.
And Beyoncé sang it for the first couple's first dance.
And
this hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What do you make of Obama's beginning? It has been quite a week in Washington. Joining us now from the Capitol is Ruth Marcus, editorial writer and columnist at The Washington Post. Ruth, great to have you back.
Hi. Anything happened this week?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe just a little. Also with us from Washington, Joseph Williams, deputy bureau chief for the Boston Globe. Joe, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, welcome.
Hello, Tom, Ruth, and Joe.
All kinds of news, things happening rat-a-tat-tat in the new Obama administration. But let's not forget that day. We all saw it, and a million, how many, two on the mall. Here's President Barack Obama taking office Tuesday and in his inaugural address citing an interesting reference from Scripture.
We remain a young nation, but in the words of Scripture, the time has come to set aside childish things. The time has come to reaffirm our enduring spirit, to choose our better history, to carry forward that precious gift, that noble idea passed on from generation to generation, the God-given promise that all are equal, all are free, and all deserve a chance to pursue their full measure of happiness.
Barack Obama above that enormous crowd on the National Mall. Joe, Ruth, you've been there all week, but Joe, first to you. Just give us a sense of this week and how it unfolded. The feeling of this week, Joe.
Well, the feeling has been incredible. It's really hard to overstate how enormous the moment was. It was sort of like a world party, a world moment, and it started Saturday with a train trip that was very high profile. Sunday was the concert with about 800,000 on the mall that was sort of a dress rehearsal. And culminating with events on Monday and certainly Tuesday was the big show. And it was really something that was remarkable, profound, impressive. Any adjective you want to pick that's positive and big is about where things were at. People were very, very patient with the long lines and the crowds. Everybody wanted to just sort of grasp a piece of the moment, even if they were half a mile from or a quarter mile from the Capitol on the Lincoln Memorial, listening and watching on Jumbotron to people who just wanted to be in the city. It was quite a moment, very extraordinary, something I've never seen before. And something I'm sure a lot of people would feel the same way about.
And then the dancing and the balls and the tears and the cheers. And Ruth Marcus, here we have this young president, 47 years old, and in the reference we played just there, talking about the time coming to set aside childish things. What's Barack Obama talking about? How do you see the big message he's bringing in his first week, Ruth?
I think that one of the I agree with everything that Joe said, and the one adjective that I'd add there is euphoric. I was on the mall, and that was the atmosphere there, just complete euphoria. And despite the huge crowds, everybody was getting along remarkably well. But I think that the surprising thing about the president's inaugural speech was how kind of gloomy and serious it was to contrast with this euphoric mood that he was confronting. And he has been sending this message consistently, really, and increasingly since he was elected, which is we face serious problems. We've put off hard choices. When he came to the Washington Post the week before the inauguration, he said, we've kicked the can down the road and we have to stop. We've reached the end of the road. And he's talking about in that situation, he was talking about the financial situation, the fiscal situation, and the problem of entitlements. But there are a lot of other very difficult choices that have been put off, both economically and in foreign policy.
Jack, here we are with this president and this sense that Joe and Ruth both describe in Washington of hope, even euphoria. We'll have to ask how Republicans felt about it. But at the same time, Jack, here's the challenges just horning in like crazy. And through all that hope, we're broke.
Yeah, you know, we have a sense that everything is different. The sky above is blue, yet really nothing fundamental has changed. The wars go on, the economy sinks apace. You know, in the campaign, Barack Obama made 500 promises, yet such is the magnitude of the election, of his election as our first black president, that even if he met all 500, that would still fall short. On the new scale of possibility. You know, it's just as his acceptance speech did not meet the expectations raised by his being the one delivering it, so I suspect that his deeds as president may pale before his symbolic power. His most profound effect may well wind up being on our dreams, which have all got bigger overnight. It's official. Anything is possible in America.
Okay, maybe so. Giant symbol, no question about it, but we need deeds here because, you know, the dragons that need slaying are many and they are enormous. But Ruth, let me just ask you, Jack said right there, nothing fundamental changed. Do you agree, Ruth?
Well, I do think that obviously something fundamental changed with the realization, and that's why I think that the euphoria was, in a sense, a bipartisan euphoria, that the country managed to overcome the terrible stain on its past of slavery and discrimination and elect a black president. That's, you know, not to say that problems of racism and discrimination and the legacy of those have been eliminated. But, of course, nothing has changed in the sense that we were talking about just before. We still have these very serious problems to deal with, and that goes to the message that the new president was conveying.
And the childish things he asked the country to set aside, Joe, how could you describe them? Like what?
Where shall we start?
Well, we still like to dance. We saw that.
Well, bipartisan bickering, interfraternal warfare. Mm. Turf battles in D.C., different kinds of ideological fights that were distractions, the abortion fight, which really didn't come up as a huge campaign issue, but certainly the culture wars sort of thing, I think, was his reference. And just to echo what both Ruth and Jack had said, mm-hmm. that the mood here is optimistic, but there were two very stark things that I took away from. One was that there was this mood of this hope. I had a friend who was anticipating this just like Christmas morning. She couldn't sleep. She got up at 4, went down to the mall, was already crowded. And that triggered a thought in me that was like, okay, people are not really grasping, or at least haven't grasped yet, the moment that he's talking about. You know, we face difficult challenges. Things are going to be really hard. He's giving these speeches and these talks saying, folks, don't get too excited. We got a lot of problems here. I may not be able to fix them all. But judging by my friend, the anticipation was, yeah, hard choices, tough road. Okay, are you president yet? And then at one of the celebrations that I was at, I ran into a couple from USAID, and they were saying, this is a new day. This is fantastic. We think things are only going to be up from here. And I paused for a second. I said, yeah, but you know, you guys ain't going to get no more money. I mean, there's nothing there to give
nothing
you.
Nothing
in the kitty to give you. So, well, we're going to have to survive on love. You know, he's going to give us a lot more love. We're going to have to survive on that alone. And really, that's a lot more than we've had. We've been down so long, it feels like up to us. And that, I think, is probably the most succinct way to put it. Even though things are going to be rough and will be rough, and even though he has reminded people of that repeatedly, just holding on to the moment for right now is enough for a lot of people. Just being able to be there and see possibility, see the optimism and be inspired, knowing that as a nation we're going to have to go through some really, really tough times, and he's already going to have to make a lot of hard choices that are going to disappoint some people.
Ruth, it was big, but survive on love, an end to partisanship in your town?
Well, you know that you can have improvements. Mm-hmm. It may not be Christmas morning every day, but I am interested in that analogy because the sort of Barack Obama as Santa Claus comparison really contrasts with his childish things. I think that the message he was trying to convey on the childish things wasn't just that we have to start behaving like adults, but that we have to basically stop believing in Santa Claus. There is no free lunch. If you cut taxes, they do not pay for themselves. You're just putting this debt on the next generation. You cannot promise unlimited entitlements without a credible way to pay for them. I think he was talking not just about tone, but on substance, on childish things.
Jack, what do you think? The exhilaration of reality here, even tough reality?
Well, the reality principle is asserting itself everywhere. You know, you can see it even now in the sobering second thoughts that are setting in about the efficacy of this overall stimulus package. The CBO this week reckoned that less than half of the $355 billion that House Democrats want to spend on infrastructure, less than half that will be used before the end of fiscal 2010. The Washington Post reported that only 4 of the $30 billion devoted to highways will be spent before 2011, only 3 of the $18 billion for renewable energy, and less than half the amount targeted for school construction. Senator Enzen, the Nevada Republican, he cited these CBO estimates in the Finance Committee's hearing on Timothy Geithner's nomination, asking Geithner, how does this stimulate the economy? How indeed?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Obama all over, Guantanamo, Geithner, Hillary at state. A new era, you tell us. Ruth Marcus is with us from the Washington Post. Joe Williams from the Boston Globe and our own Jack Beatty's here. Let's begin to hear from the people. Dana, Dennis, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Dana.
Hi, Tom. Hi, guests.
Hi.
I'm a very grateful supporter of Obama, but I have two reservations. And one is, he is not a messiah, nor should he be. We are a democracy. We should not be voting for a messiah. And second of all, or a hero for that matter. Second of all, I'm really concerned that he might get co-opted. We have to be very careful about that. He could get co-opted by the Washington Defense Establishment, big finance. I'm really concerned about that. And I hope we on the left can, you know, be vigilant and hold them accountable.
Dana, we've got it. Yes to Obama, no to Messiah, and vigilance on the left. Let's go to John in Amherst, New York. John, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm coming from a little bit different perspective. I am not a liberal. I am a conservative.
Okay.
I virtually dismissed my Republican Party because they have not been at all conservative, and they don't believe in what they have. Now, we have a liberal panel today, and I have no problem at all with that. But I would like to actually look at this from a standpoint of this is nothing more than idolatry. This man has really not accomplished a lot in his life other than getting elected to president, which in itself is a great feat. I still wonder why he was catapulted to where he was. But that being said, I want to point something out that you people probably haven't even looked at. I kind of nuanced this thing.
You people. Okay, I don't know who you mean, but let's hear it, John. Let's hear it.
Liberal.
Let's hear it.
What happened was that we had executive orders issued, and Guantanamo's not closed, guys. It's not closed, and nor will it be in a year. But that's a prediction. What happened is that he's issued a couple of executive orders, one for the closing of Gitmo. But and when he was having his little press conference,
Hey, John, he's the president, right? Liberal or conservative, he's the president.
No, that's fine, but he actually...
What's little about a press conference? What was little about it?
Well, what happened was that he was asked by someone about his executive order regarding the closing of Gitmo. When asked, he had to go to his lawyer to tell him exactly what his executive order was. Now, Tom, I am no expert, I'm not a political hack, but I have to believe that an executive order goes right to the heart and the passion of what a person believes, and he's got to talk to his Greg Craig, and also the press secretary had to go to Greg Craig.
Hey, the president's got a lawyer, we got it. But I take your point, John. It is tough stuff when it comes to exactly how interrogation and everything else goes, and we will look at exactly that. But let me go first to these issues. Ruth, let me come to you. We've got a liberal caller who says, love Obama, but, hey, we don't need a messiah here, and is he going to be co-opted by Washington? A conservative caller who says, idolatry he saw on the National Mall. What do you say, Ruth?
Well, there is a risk of both. I expect that President Obama will be getting as much, if not more, grief from the liberal side of his own party as he will from getting criticism from the right and disappointed conservatives. We've already seen that, for example, with his comments about how he thinks we need to look forward rather than look back in terms of prosecuting people for torture and investigating past misdeeds of the previous administration. I would like to comment on the callers you picked up on the little press conference note. The conservative caller, I understand because his approach, because I recoil from some of the Obama mania myself. But I do think that to suggest that this president didn't understand the scope of his executive order, I think he is remarkably smart, agree with him or disagree with him. His understanding of issues, and especially given his relatively short time in public life, is extraordinarily deep and nuanced. And of all the concerns I have about President Obama, the least of them is that he's not smart enough for the job.
Let's go straight to that moment on the substance. Here's Obama signing his first executive order.
First executive order that we are signing by the authority vested in me as president by the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, in order to effect the appropriate disposition of individuals currently detained by the Department of Defense at Guantanamo, and promptly to close the detention facility at Guantanamo consistent with the national security and foreign policy interests of the United States and the interests of justice, I hereby order. And we then provide the process whereby Guantanamo will be closed no later than 1 year from now.
Barack Obama with his first executive order. Jack Beatty, The Washington Post, Dana Priest, headline has it, the war on terror is being ended right here as President Bush pursued it. And there was step one right there.
Yeah, we're probably going to pursue it in a novel way, consistent with our Constitution. You know, really, with those executive orders, Obama did more to help our standing in world opinion in one day than Bush did in 8 years. That's symbolism that really means something. But you know, John called and he was worried about the Republican Party getting away from its orthodoxies and going too far and leaving conservatism behind. And yet this has been a week of strange statements from Republicans on that. Jim DeMint of South Carolina says he's looking to form a GOP remnant, quote, to stop the slide towards socialism. John Boehner, he said the prisoners at Gitmo, they get treatment that's, quote, a lot better than a lot of Americans. James Inhofe, the senator from Oklahoma on Bill Bennett's radio show, said that he's won on global warming. People don't call it that anymore. They call it climate change. That shows an agreement for him. So on and on.
What's your point with these, Jack?
My point is that the Republicans are, in fact, sounding more conservative, and that may not be to their advantage. For example, in the red states, in Texas, Obama's approval rate is now 62%. And McCain carried Texas by 11 points. In Tennessee, he's at 60%. McCain carried it by 17 points. And there's a way in which the GOP is forcing itself or being forced by its core constituency further to the right than what appears to be the national consensus. And these statements and hold the Senator Cornyn putting a hold on Holder's nomination because he wants the commitment that the people that committed torture won't be prosecuted for it. These are things that are almost outside the mainstream, or some of them are, to be sure. And I think it shows the dilemma of the GOP.
The GOP will have its day, and we'll get to it, how conservatives deal with this. But I want to stick with the substantive issue of Guantanamo, interrogation, torture, if you will, first. Here's Admiral Dennis Blair, Obama's new pick for Director of National Intelligence, testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee this week.
Torture is not moral. not legal. It's not effective. The U.S. government will have a clear and consistent standard for treatment of detainees. The Guantanamo Detention Center will be closed. It's become a damaging symbol.
Will be closed. It's a damaging signal, symbol. Torture not effective. And yet, Joe Williams here, I'm looking at a New York Times story out this morning saying that one of those who had earlier been released from Guantanamo Bay, a Saudi Arabian, has emerged as a leader of Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen since his release from Guantanamo. This is not simple stuff, Joe.
No, and it's also the best example that the Republicans are pointing to for reasons why Guantanamo and enhanced interrogations were necessary tools for President Bush to use in the war on terror. And at the press conference yesterday, Robert Gibbs was asked about this. There was also a background briefing. And I think they understand the complexities of this issue, but it seems like the big, broad symbols held the day. They were pressed on how they would be able to sort the really violent extremists that are probably going to go back into jihadism upon their release versus the bulk of people who were being held without charge or held with charges that weren't necessarily provable in court. And they said, well, we're studying it and we'll get back to you. We can't tell you right now how we're going to do this. We don't know right now how we're going to do this. Ultimately was the message. We have to study it and find out and come up with an answer. So there are a few things that the details of which are still going to be worked out. They're going to try to do the best they can. It's complex. It's got a lot of trap doors to it that they're going to have to be careful to avoid. And I think even with that care, they're probably going to fall through a trap door or two nonetheless.
Obama, pretty clear, though, on the big picture. Jack Beatty saying more good done for America's global standing in one day there than in many years recently. I want to turn to the economy, because you mentioned this, Jack, and Ruth and Joe referred as well. The economy is so scary that, of course, there are concerns. But here you've got, for example, in the Times today, left and right, Paul Krugman and David Brooks, both looking at the stimulus package and saying, in Krugman's case, not enough, too conventional, the message and plans coming from Obama. In Brooks' case, you know, it's going to be too late. And not fundamental enough in the way it changes the economy. Ruth, what about the future of Obama's stimulus plans and the economy itself? I mean, the Dow way down on the day he took the oath.
It's all very scary, and not least for the people who are charged with fixing it. The dichotomy on the Times op-ed page today is very telling. And the truth is, nobody knows who's right. They both have good points. Is $825 billion enough? Will the $825 billion arrive too late, and will it be spent in the right way to do the trick? We don't know. The people that I talk to suggest that the risks of doing too little are small. I'm trying to get my risks right. sorry about that. There's more of a problem in doing too little than too much, or on the side of doing too much. There's a limit to David Brooks, who I respect enormously, has a good point, as do the Republicans, in the slow spend out rate of the stimulus. Nonetheless, there is a limit to how quickly you can spend money. And there is a limit, certainly, to how quickly you can spend money responsibly. And there is a trade-off that's going on here. These are all really important to discuss. They'll be debated as this stimulus package goes through. We saw it begin this week and the markups in the House. And I think these are really difficult questions. And the reality is nobody knows the right answer. And we're all scared.
Let's go to Dan in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Dan, you're on the air.
Well, yes. Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. The reason I called in is I didn't vote for this president, but I sure am going to support him. Okay, we got a lot of issues in the country, and I think it's time to get down to work. I hear a lot of ideology mm-hmm. going on. Let's do something. My particular point these days is I'm eager to hear about the president's education initiatives. I think we've got to look to the future of the next generation. And the single significant point that I think that, even though it's not necessarily federally legislated, you know, we know that the education is normally reserved to the states, but we need to go back to where the building principals, the men and women that run the schools, have terminating authority over their staff. in too many places, people will say you can't fire an errant teacher. Well, that's not necessarily true. It can take 2.5 years to change a staff member.
Dan, I think we see the whole picture. You didn't vote for him, you support him, and you say it's time to get down to business, and you're ready to get right down to brass tacks on the education front. Agenda is popping up here for Obama's attention right across the horizon. Joe, how about it? There's readiness to support, but also just a hunger, kind of as Obama says, but a hunger to get down to it. I mean, education, we'll see what he brings, but what about simple pacing? He's come out pretty fast out of the gate with a drumbeat of action here. He's signing these executive orders. It's not all sewn up, but he's getting down to business pretty quick.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, I'm sort of reminded of another phrase. It's better to burn out than to fade away, but certainly he's got a lot of work cut out for him, and all these agendas are going to be competing, and it's going to be some difficult, really hard choices. A lot of people are going to be disappointed. Education, he may not have all the answers for that, and there are some reform issues that people will be fighting over. Certainly, everybody who I've talked to, and even some people in various aspects of government, do feel this need to get to business, that the problems are huge. But we've got to start somewhere. It was such a catharsis moment that people are really ready and willing to take advantage of it. And it reminds me of a friend quip once that this was sort of like the reverse 9/11 moment, where after 9/11, President Bush had this huge public support, this huge political capital, spent it, and the left would argue squandered it in Iraq, leaving Afghanistan half finished and invading Iraq. Here, this is a similar sort of moment where people know that the country is faced with a huge challenge. They're ready to work. They're ready to act. He seems like he's going to try to take advantage of that. There are already public service announcements that he made even before he was inaugurated, calling people to public service. A lot of the civil servants, you saw the reaction that Hillary Clinton got mm-hmm. when she was at the State Department. There were cheers, applause when she said, "Let's get to work. You know, we're going to change things. We've got a huge job ahead of us. Let's start now." And that's basically, among some of the best principles of leadership, where if you have a moment like this, you've got to take advantage of it. The danger for him also, in addition to pacing, is that people will feel they can't help but feel disappointed because expectations are so high. He's tried to manage them. Not everybody was listening. And when reality sets in, the challenge will be whether or not people are still willing and motivated to get down to business.
Here's Obama talking challenges on Inauguration Day.
Our nation is at war against a far-reaching network of violence and hatred. Our economy is badly weakened, a consequence of greed and irresponsibility on the part of some, but also our collective failure to make hard choices and prepare the nation for a new age.
Barack Obama, January 20th, 2009. Chris in Wallingford, Vermont. Chris, you're on.
Yes, hi. I look at Obama and I look at what's been going on with him, and I'm just amazed at his leadership style. And my point is that really leadership is a lot about who you surround yourself with, obviously. I mean, one point is Robert Gates, and I think Mr. Gates was probably a bit shocked, like, wow, he's asking me to stay on. And just the other people who he surrounded himself by shows that he's something of a servant leader. He's an incredibly intelligent man, obviously, but he's also very humble, which I think it's huge. And so my point being is that I'm very impressed, of course. I am a Democrat, I'll freely admit that, but I'm just like, whoa, this guy is showing by his actions that, he's a leader. And ultimately, he's going to bring us to a place where neither he nor we know exactly where it's going to be. I mean, because it's going to be determined largely by the people who surround himself by, and largely comes down to you, me, all of us as individuals.
We're headed straight into that future, Chris, and we hear it. Whoa, let's go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, a big week. Americans weren't the only ones to celebrate Obama's inauguration. Listen to this woman in Kenya.
It's been like a roller coaster, an emotional one, and I still feel it in my inside. It's like an overwhelming thing. It's like bubbling.
Bubbling in Kenya. Barbara and Jenna Bush wrote a letter to the new first daughters, Sasha and Malia Obama, recorded here for MSNBC, about life in the White House.
So here's our most important piece of advice.
Remember who your dad really is.
And the quartet of Yo-Yo Ma, Anthony McGill, Gabrielle Montero, and Itzhak Perlman performed composer John Williams' Simple Gifts arrangement at President Obama's inauguration. They played, but it turns out the performance piped out to the millions on the mall was pre-recorded. Too cold to keep the instruments in tune, they said. Do you care? Ruth Marcus is with us today from the Washington Post. Joe Williams from the Boston Globe. Jack Beatty's here. Here's a voice we haven't heard much of recently from the campaign trail. Now, back on Capitol Hill, here's John McCain talking about bringing Hillary Clinton on as Secretary of State.
I really believe, Mr. President, that we should move forward with the nomination of our former colleague, I guess our still present colleague, Senator Hillary Clinton, to take up the urgent and important duties that she holds, which are to meet some very serious challenges.
Bring on Secretary of State Clinton, said John McCain, and they did, 94-2. She very quickly tapped Richard Holbrooke for Pakistan, India, Afghanistan, and all the trouble there, and George Mitchell for the Middle East. Here was George Mitchell pledging strong involvement in the conflict to bring, in the effort to bring peace to the Middle East.
I believe deeply that with committed, persevering, and patient diplomacy, it can happen in the Middle East. There are, of course, many, many reasons to be skeptical about the prospect for success. The conflict has gone on for so long and has had such destructive effects that many have come to regard it as unchangeable and inevitable. But the President and the Secretary of State don't believe that.
George Mitchell, picked by Hillary Clinton to head to the Middle East. And Ruth Marcus, we're told he's going to be heading out there very soon. What do you make of these two men, Mitchell and Holbrooke, on these two intractable hotspots?
Intractable is the right word. These are two very serious, committed, experienced diplomats. They don't have any illusions that their job is going to be easy or that they'll be able to come up with some quick solution. But I think it's very important, given the number of things on the new president's plate, to sort of have somebody who is as skilled as those two men are to really kind of sit on that issue and address it from the get-go. One of the criticisms I think that is fairly made of the Bush administration and other previous administrations is that it did not pay enough attention to the Mideast until too late in the game. And so if you don't start dealing with this problem right away, you are never going to deal with it.
Joe Williams, is there enough firepower here, no matter who the president, no matter who the people, to take on all these big issues at once, the economy, all the issues back in the States, plus the Middle East, plus South Asia?
It's going to be difficult. There's a lot of firepower in the room. Not every problem is going to be solved. And I think that he's already, the president has already tried to strongly hint that. And taking them all at once, I think, is probably more important symbolically to look as though you are taking action and addressing it, knowing that probably the solutions are certainly going to be staggered if they come at all. And certainly that trying to at least address some of the issues, trying to pick up and clean up what's been left behind or what's been sort of festering for many, many years, or at least in recent months, is not going to be easy. I don't think he's got any other choice. I mean, I think that trying to kick the Middle East can down the road is not going to work. Trying to sort of finesse a few other things probably isn't going to work. You've got to dive in and see how far you can get.
Here's Hillary Clinton arriving yesterday. I'll come straight to you, Jack. Here she is at the State Department after being sworn in as Secretary of State. Employees whooping and hollering in the big flag festooned lobby at Foggy Bottom.
There are three legs to the stool of American foreign policy.
defense, diplomacy, and development. And we are responsible for two of the three legs. And we will make clear as we go forward that diplomacy and development are essential tools in achieving the long-term objectives of the United States.
Jack Beatty, there's that voice. In this role, if things had gone a little bit differently, she might have been president of the United States, maybe with that firepower there. Maybe Obama can take on a lot at once.
Yeah, the watchword is smart power. There's a lot of smart there. There's a lot of ambition there. And in Hillary's case, perhaps smarter even than we know. I mean, by beefing off the Middle East to Mitchell, she avoids some of the, the negative features of handling that. The Mitchell appointment, I think, is really significant for who he is. He's a Lebanese-American. He's notably fair-minded on this issue. He issued a report in the closing days of the Clinton administration. Actually, it was given in the first days of the Bush administration, criticizing Palestinians for terrorism, but also making a big point about stopping the settlements on the West Bank on the Israeli side. And I think it was notable, too, that President Obama expressed compassion for the suffering of Palestinian civilians in that conference. That was a small step, but I think an important one to gain some credibility there, because the way things are going, you just can't see any future there. We've had this three-week air and ground assault, yet 40% of the tunnels from Egypt are still operating. And they were sending in, they were being used as early as Thursday. And, of course, they're sending in material that will allow Hamas to rearm and commit its own war crimes, which is firing indiscriminately on Israeli civilians, which may require another Israeli incursion. And what have the Israelis got out of this? You know, Hamas appears to be stronger than before, Fatah weaker, and the Israeli right, from what the polls say, resurgent. And the human cost, according to one study, 280 children and minors killed, 103 women. According to a study cited by Juan Cole, Hamas, there were 223 Hamas fighters killed. That is to say, more children killed than Hamas fighters.
Obama says he'll do something about those tunnels, something effective. We'll see. Let's go to Ithaca, New York, and Faye. Faye, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, a couple of quick thoughts. Number one, there should be four legs to the stool. That last leg should be peace in the world, promoting peace. We should be promoting peace and not just the other three comments that issues that Hillary brought up. The second thing is I've been very much for impeachment. And the reason I say that of the last administration is because even though Obama does not want to look back, which I highly disagree with him, it's going to be very hard for him to clean up this mess. And that's why I think accountability needed to be made. And the third thought is the issue of Gaza. I don't like how the response was yesterday in the press conference about Gaza and what Israel has done. And that all is going to come back to haunt us. And that's where, like, people like us, the American people, need to join with this administration and demand accountability. We don't sit back. Obama's going to do good things. I know he will, but we need to do more. We need to demand more, and we need to demand more honesty.
Faye, you're in upstate New York. Let me ask you about one more point. Caroline Kennedy and her withdrawal as, from the running for U.S. Senator from New York, and your governor headed in a new direction today. What do you make of that?
Well, obviously, without all the facts, we don't know. I do like Ms. Kennedy, but I don't know anything about her. Basically, I don't think it's fair to put someone in office because they have a name. You know, I mean, we do need experience these days. Experience is very important. So, in terms of why she bailed out, who knows? I mean, I don't
Let's ask, and thanks very much, Joe. There's a word from Ithaca. What do you know at this point about Caroline Kennedy and why she was in and now she's not in? Was Governor Patterson just headed another way? Or what about all this stuff on nanny, taxes, personal issues? I don't know what to think.
Well, judging by what's coming out, A, he was headed in a new direction. B, she probably had a lot more problems than what was apparent early on. C, there appears to be at least a little bit of acrimony leaking out between her and Governor Patterson's office. There's been some sniping back and forth. His office saying that it's obvious she wasn't ready for prime time. her office saying that, well, they didn't give us a fair shake and maybe there might not have been a fair hearing, and she was trying to do all the right things. Certainly on its face, you could probably make a case for her recusing herself for personal reasons. That's the standard Washington thing, you know, resigning to spend more time with your family or for
but
personal
she wasn't
reasons.
Even in there yet. I mean,
exactly. But clearly something went on. The whole story is emerging slowly, and it looks like there's a bigger picture than just initially what was thought early on yesterday and the day before.
Let's get one more dangling soul out there. Timothy Geithner, Obama's nominee for Treasury Secretary, testifying this week before Congress, explaining he said that he was careless in figuring out his taxes. This is the man in line to be Treasury Secretary when it surfaced that he had owed $34,000 in unpaid payroll taxes.
I should have been more careful. I take full responsibility for them. I have gone back and corrected these errors and paid what I owed.
Ruth Marcus, how do you look at that at the end of this week and some pretty tough grilling of Geithner on the Hill?
I'm very troubled by the situation that we're in with the Geithner nomination. The New York Times actually had a wonderful lead in its story about him the other day that he's too big to fail. In other words, that we're at this point, we're so far down the road with the nomination, we really do need a Treasury Secretary in place. He does seem to be otherwise qualified, that to hold him up at this point might not be the best thing for the country. At the same time, I do not diminish the seriousness of the problems that he had, because it wasn't just one bit of laxity. It was several bits of laxity. It was not cleaning up a mess that he should have known was there in terms of the previous years that he hadn't paid the proper taxes for. So I'm very concerned about where this leaves us. I do expect that he will be confirmed, but I do think that this is a problem. I want to get back to Caroline Kennedy for 1 minute, if I could. Mm-hmm. I disagree that I'm not really sure that the governor was leaning against her. Mm-hmm. I think there is something else going on that has nothing to do with either not getting the job or nanny taxes or Ted Kennedy's health that we don't yet know about. And I cannot believe how badly both sides in this transaction botched it. Both Governor Patterson and Caroline Kennedy really did not show themselves in a good light here.
Nothing smooth about the way all that went. Let's go to Rachel in Boston. Rachel, you're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment about Michelle Obama. I'm so excited to have her in the White House along with the president. I'm 40 years old, and it's the first time that I felt like there is a woman in the White House who gets it, who understands what it's like to be part of a family where both parents are working with young kids. And as a working mom of two, I finally feel like someone's going to be out there saying, hey, the American family is having a tough time. And she knows firsthand how hard that is.
Do you think the pillow talk will be on your side with Michelle Obama there?
Finally.
How about the dress, Rachel? How about the dress at the balls?
Who cares? I don't care. I thought she looked great, but what's most important to me is that she's bright, she's compassionate. Clearly, she and her husband have a very strong relationship, which makes me feel good about them being there together. She can wear whatever she wants.
we got it. Rachel, thanks very much. Jack?
But you know, those dresses, they embody the new multiracial, multicultural American reality, which is validated in Barack Obama's story. Consider, her day dress and jacket were created by Isabel Toledo, an American Cuban-born. 26-year-old Jason Wu of Taipei in Vancouver designed her evening dress. He learned his trade in New York from Narciso Rodriguez, whose clothes she wore to another event. And I borrowed this information, Tom, from a Wall Street Journal story written by Cheryl Lou Lin Tan.
Okay.
Obama, Toledo, Wu, Rodriguez, and Tan. You know, it doesn't trip off the old white guy tongue like Tinker's to Ever's to Chance.
Right.
But his tongue had better get used to the new syllables of success in Barack
Obama's
America.
It's a new world, but it's ours. Let's get one last call. Rick in Charleston. Rick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I consider myself to be a conservative. I generally vote Republican. But I like the president. I think it's a watershed for America that we have a minority, the chief executive of this country of ours. As far as his policies with Guantanamo and the war on terror, If he does what he aims to do and keeps the country safe, then he deserves all the credit in the world. However, if we do suffer another attack under his watch, then perhaps President Bush should get a little bit more credit for what he did.
Rick, we hear it. And if that happens, we know we'll hear it again. Ruth, that hangs over everything here. The economy unsolved, the terror threat by no means vanished, and Barack Obama now aims his skiff out into those big seas.
Sure does, and but at least he'll have the company of our new fashion correspondent, Jack, to do it.
That's great. Joe Williams, our African-American friend, big week on that front. We haven't talked much about it, but that talk about turning a page. It was huge, and you've got to be feeling it, you know, in the family personally this week.
Well, yeah, personally, it was remarkable. When I was a kid growing up, we heard the same thing that most bright kids do. You know, you could grow up to be president someday, and you know, you kind of like, well, yeah, right, okay, mm-hmm. thanks very much, and you kind of use it as a motivating right. tool to tell you that you can be anything you want to be. But president, no way, you know, that's never mm-hmm. going to happen. But certainly, a lot of tears, a lot of welling up, pride. Some reminders that I got from a church that I was at that, well, yeah, this is great, this is fantastic, but you know what? Plenty of work to go.
A lot of work to go, but also a lot of pride this week and justified for many Americans, all Americans, at the basic level. Joe Williams with the Boston Globe, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much for being here today, Joe.
You're welcome. Thanks, Tom.
Ruth Marcus at the Washington Post, you're great, and thank you very much for joining us, Ruth.
My pleasure.
Jack Beatty, there it goes, a week for the history books.
Skies above a blue.
The skies above our blue at last. Thanks to Beyonce for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.